Hello, this is episode 29 of A Socialist Reads Atlas Shrugged. My name is Jonathan Seyfried. I am the self-identified socialist, and I am doing a close reading of the novel Atlas Shrugged by Ayn Rand. To start off today's episode, let's ponder a question. An unanswerable question. And that question is, what makes great art great? What makes great art great? This is something that there's just tons of books that you can read about, tons of arguments that you can have. And it's basically the field within philosophy called aesthetics. And the arguments about what makes great art great really go back all the way to the beginnings of art itself. And in many ways, you can't win one side of an argument here. You can just keep asking questions. And one of the things that's come up about art is that sometimes you have art that celebrates the struggle of the individual, the triumph of a particular hero, or the elevation of consciousness, individual consciousness. And other times you have art that emphasizes symbiosis, that emphasizes being connected to a bigger picture in terms of the natural world. You can have art that emphasizes how we're all in this together as humans and plays down the heroism of one particular individual. So these are matters of taste. And as we get into the next scene in chapter 4 of Atlas Shrugged, we are going to see what Dagny's taste in art is. And we're going to see that through her experience listening to the music of Richard Halley. Let's open up the book. So after observing examples of culture that deserve critique, if not scorn, Dagny arrives back to her apartment. Oh, and just parenthetically, let me say that Dagny scorns what she sees. But in last episode, I explained how there's an issue when we're looking at Dagny's reaction to the novel. She doesn't actually have much of a reaction to it. She just notices it. But I mean, come on, we're meant to see this as something bad. But then, you know, talked about leisure culture and so on in a way that definitely had some scorn in the critique. All right, so there's been scorn, even though we, in this analysis that I'm doing here, looked at it a little bit in with some more complication. But anyway, Dagny is back to her apartment. There's only a little bit of description of her apartment, but motion comes up, where the fact that she has this glass corner in her apartment is something that reminds her of motion, like a ship's bow. It's pretty swanky, I think. Swanky modernist New York apartment. I like it. And then we have the phonograph of Richard Halley. And we get introduced to the fourth concerto with a little bit of telling, not showing. And the telling here is that it's a cry of rebellion, that it is a no flung at some vast process of torture, a denial of suffering, a denial that held the agony of the struggle to break free. That was a quote, by the way. Sorry about that. Usually like to introduce the quotes with saying the word quote. Well, here we go. Here's the next sentence. Quote, the sounds were like a voice saying, there is no necessity for pain. Why, then, is the worst pain reserved for those who will not accept its necessity? We who hold the love and the secret of joy, to what punishment have we been sentenced for it, and by whom? The sounds of torture became defiance. The statement of agony became a hymn to a distant vision for whose sake anything was worth enduring. Even this, it was the song of rebellion and of a desperate quest. Unquote. All right, that right there is what's going to happen toward the end of the book. There's going to be someone who's punished and then cries out in kind of in pain, but also has a secret of joy. So this is all kind of in a foreshadowing here. But we have to untangle this. Like, what does this all mean? What is the worst pain? And why is it reserved for those who will not accept its necessity? So what does that mean? All right. Paraphrasing here. Those who believe that suffering has a purpose. Okay, so we'll take the other side here, right? Those who think there is a necessity for pain, they have a level of comfort. Why? Because if you believe that your pain has a purpose, it's easier to endure it. Kind of makes sense. But if you are someone who says there is no necessity for pain, then you're not going to have that comforting thought of, well, this is painful, but it means something. There's a good reason for I'm earning something through this pain is a way that you can, you know, more readily endure the pain. And so those who are going to be like, nope, they're more atheist maybe about things, right? Like if you don't believe that you're going to be rewarded for your suffering, then it's a little hard to endure the suffering, right? It just sucks, and that's it. Life's not fair, that kind of thing. It's a lot harder to stomach that, you know? You don't have an idea that it's worth anything. So, you have something extra in your suckiness when you go through pain, if that's how you feel about it. If that's what you believe about it, that there's nothing to believe, then, yeah, it's just pain, and it sucks. So that's how I understand that. And at the same time, the cry of defiance is saying, wow, that's so unfair. If you can delude yourself into thinking that your pain has some meaning to it, then you get rewarded in the here and now. That's not fair, because there's a secret, right? There's those who are in the know who realize that pain is not necessary, that you're not going to win points for unnecessary suffering. That unnecessary suffering is just holding yourself back, maybe even going so far as to rationalize your own lack of trust in your own abilities, a way to get comfort in avoidance, right? Kind of an avoidance behavior in a way. And so there's a lot of psychological stuff being implied here. And Ayn Rand is an atheist. Don't forget that. And I don't want to write off faith traditions to the extent that Ayn Rand does. Ayn Rand really hated Buddhism. And one of the reasons, and later on in the book, there's someone who becomes Buddhist, and that person is just meant to be scorned in the worst way. But one of the reasons that Ayn Rand doesn't like Buddhism is because Buddhism emphasizes an acknowledgement of suffering in a way that you're not supposed to fight against it. You're supposed to be more accepting of it. And we see here an expression of Ayn Rand's resistance against that idea and saying, no, you should defy. You should not give in to this idea that you have to have suffering. You should do everything you can to not suffer, because if you don't, you're giving up. And then you're just going to end up like Jim Taggart, who gave up on life, and you're going to be depressed. So, you know, the gradient here is way more complicated, of course, and there's going to be other moments where this is addressed. So I don't want to belabor it all that much in this instance, because there's other episodes in the story that I think are going to make this a whole lot more clear. And also, if you've read The Fountainhead, that book is kind of completely focused on that issue. But just suffice it to say, for us at this moment in the book, to try to understand why Dagny likes this music so much, it's because somehow Richard Halley has captured a defiance, a kind of defiance. And I would say that there's a lot to be celebrated in the sort of defiance here. So I've got mixed feelings, right? It's the whole, again, mixed feelings, because on the one hand, I feel it's important, like in the sense of the philosopher Viktor Frankl, that you should have meaning. You should attribute meaning to your suffering. Maybe if it's not directly in a faith tradition, at least within your own personhood and the way that you interact with others after you've been through the pain, and you can then help others to make it through. That's kind of, in essence, what Viktor Frankl is saying. And that, I think, is not necessarily saying that the pain is a necessity, but there is a purpose there. So I take issue with the kind of full-on atheism going on here. But at the same time, I really do agree that defiance in terms of not just wallowing, maybe, like having a kind of resistance, that each of us should have an expression of resistance, that's empowering. We should seek out that empowerment. That's a good thing. So again, there's stuff that I agree with here, as well as implications that I find to be a problem. One other thing that you want to take note of is when you start to see cultish kinds of things come up, like some people know the secret, like the elite, they have the secret. You know, I really am wary of that kind of stuff, because then you get into this elitism where, ah, you're in the know, you've unlocked the mystery of life, you know the real values, and people who don't, they therefore don't deserve your respect. And that's dangerous, and that is something that Ayn Rand does nothing to address or ameliorate in the kind of thing that she's creating here. I mean, her own movement has been accused, for good reasons, I think, of being very cultish. And you can kind of see that starting to germinate at this stage in the book. All right. Now, when we get into the biography of Richard Halley, Ayn Rand starts to engage with some tropes about artists. And in the first full paragraph on page 70, we have this series of conditions that Richard Halley goes through. There's a lot of stairs in the tenement, right? And it's a struggle, and there's suffering. It's the trope of the tortured artist. So that's kind of interesting that we have someone who went through a period of hardship that you would think is supporting the idea that there's a necessity to pain that you kind of go through as a tortured artist, and then that helps to make your work deeper. That's the usual way that we think about the tortured artist trope. But instead, Richard Halley is kind of pissed off about that and pushes back against it in a way that I'm not quite sure is fully expressed here. We have an interesting parallel between the story of Nat Taggart and the story of Richard Halley, where they're each coming from nothing, and then through their hard work, they gain acclaim and accolades. And in fact, we've got Richard Halley being someone who, well, I'll just read it out here. Quote, his life had been a summary of the lives of all the men whose reward is a monument in a public park 100 years after the time when a reward can matter, unquote. So who else had a monument? Nat Taggart had a monument. So Richard Halley is celebrating that kind of glory. We have here a yearning for great man history, not the struggle of the people, but the struggle of the individual. Very important. So, what is Halley's opera about? It's about Phaeton. And if you do a little reading about the myth of Phaeton, it's really funny. It's very funny. And the reason why I think it's so funny is because it has such a modern cultural analog in current day American culture. So have you ever heard of this kind of thing happening? There's a kid, like a teenager, and they just learned how to drive, and they take the car out for a spin, and it's like a really nice car. It's like their dad's like favorite toy, and they take it out for a spin, and the very first time they take it out, they wreck it, totaled, destroyed. It's like a whole trope in our society. The kid wrecks the beautiful car their first time taking it out for a spin. That is the storyline of Phaeton. What happened with Phaeton is that he was the son of Helios, sun god, and Helios had a cool chariot, and Phaeton says, "Ooh, can I drive your sweet ride, Dad?" And Helios is like, "Okay, son, but be careful." And as soon as Phaeton takes that chariot out of the garage, boom, the pedal to the metal. What's the chariot version of that? I don't know. There's no pedals in a chariot. But whatever the chariot version of that is, Phaeton just goes nuts and drives that chariot all over the place, places it should not go. And the myth is meant to explain why there's deserts and other places that are tundra and such that are kind of difficult for settlement, harsh environmental conditions, because Phaeton rode this chariot into places it got too hot and then took it too far away from the sun, it got too cold, and then he wrecks it and he dies. So that's the story of Phaeton, and the moral of the story is that when you are young and you don't have a proper sense of physical danger and you just want to be aggressive as a driver, well, that's dangerous and you shouldn't do it. But when Richard Halley gets his hands on this myth, what does he do? He has Phaeton survive and become a hero. And so what we see is, in Ayn Rand's opinion, what would be great for culture is for people in mythology, archetypes, to, instead of being punished for their hubris, they should be rewarded. You gotta be a risk taker. You know? Get out there. Be energetic. Don't let yourself be held back by tales of people like Phaeton or Icarus, who also died as a result of some hubris action. Flying too close to the sun. That's how Icarus died. So don't worry about them. You just go for it, kids. And that is what we should celebrate. We should celebrate people who were reckless because they were ambitious. That's what we should celebrate. So there. And Dagny loves that. Because it is, in the context of the story, you can understand, in this world that Ayn Rand built up, where a lot of people are just looking to make excuses, and they're just kind of being lame, and they're timid, and they're engaged in avoidance behavior all the time, you can really understand how someone would want to cry out, if that is the world, would want to cry out, "My goodness, stop avoiding things. Stop the avoidance behavior. Just do it." Like the Nike motto says, get out there, do something. And so in that world, I too would probably want to take tales of recklessness and transform them into heroic tales of ambition. That would make sense to me. But the question you have to ask yourself as a reader of Atlas Shrugged, the question you need to ask is, the world that Ayn Rand portrays, where people are consumed with avoidance behavior and they're not making typewriters anymore, is that really our world? Is that even the world that would be the case in a successful socialist political economy? It does sound like the world of, you know, the industrialized states that call themselves communist in the 20th century. It makes sense to me that if Ayn Rand set this novel in, say, Yugoslavia, or maybe Czechoslovakia or Poland in the 1970s, yeah, okay, I get it. Totally fits. But does it really work if we think about it as a portrayal of a Western capitalist democracy? That's what you have to keep in mind. So think about it. Next, on page 71 in my edition, we find out that Dagny was in the audience on the night that the tastes of the music audience came around and realized that Richard Halley's opera was great. Dagny was in the audience that night. There was a standing ovation. And we're reminded that Dagny was one of the elite. Okay. And the implication is, like, you should try to be like this. You should be one of the few that knows the music is great before everybody else caught on. Oh my gosh, don't we all know somebody who makes this claim? They're like, oh, I knew that such and such band or such singer was so great even before they got popular. I saw them perform at the Dive before they signed on for the big record deal and everybody else knew about them. It's a point of pride for a lot of people to kind of validate their own taste and to feel special. And, you know, it's okay, fine. If you're the first to discover something is awesome, if you're one of the few, then bravo to you. And we can celebrate how you were able to recognize something awesome before it caught on. Nothing inherently wrong with that, unless you're using it as another example of how there's an elite out there and those who are not in the know are worthy of being disrespected. So keep that in mind. Again, watch out in the book for this building sense of, if you're in the know, then you are at a higher level than others. Okay, watch out for that. And then we see that Richard Halley, after the ovation, is not gonna go along with this. Richard Halley, here's what he did. Quote, he stood without moving, a tall, emaciated man with graying hair. He did not bow. He did not smile. He just stood there looking at the crowd. His face had the quiet, earnest look of a man staring at a question. Unquote. What's the question? What's the question? The question is probably, why are all of you idiots? Why is it that you like my music now and you didn't like my music before if it's supposed to be great music? Like, what is wrong with you? That's the question. What is wrong when great music is dismissed in one time and then celebrated another time? That's a super interesting question. Here's a nice example to think about. There was a time when Shakespeare was dismissed as horrible. Yeah, like in a few centuries there in between, okay, before, gosh, I'm really shaky on this, so don't quote me, but something like in the 1700s, I think, Shakespeare was considered to be trash, not worthy of reading or performing at all. And it took a turn of fashion, a turn of taste, for Shakespeare to come back and to be read again and to be revered. Because the way that we revere Shakespeare now, that was not, Shakespeare was not revered like that. Shakespeare was successful in a way that, like, an action movie director these days would be successful. You know, someone like James Cameron, right? And so the idea, well, it'll be interesting to see 200 or 300 years from now, which artists are held up, which dramatic artists, performing artists are going to be held up to that level. Probably it'll be something that surprises us. Or it could be The Sopranos. We'll see. So anyway, Richard Halley is not pleased with the trajectory of his career, even though it wound up with success. And then we've got this critic, and the critic writes that the music of Richard Halley belongs to mankind. It is the product and the expression of the greatness of the people. So attacking the individual, taking away the achievement of the individual and ascribing it to the context. That's what's going on there with that critic. I'm really big on historical context. But I think that individual artists deserve recognition for being able to capture their context. So I wouldn't go so far as this critic ever. But listen to this. A minister says something about Richard Halley. Listen to this. Here's what the minister says. Quote, "There is an inspiring lesson in the life of Richard Halley. He has had a terrible struggle, but what does that matter? It is proper, it is noble, that he should have endured suffering, injustice, abuse at the hands of his brothers in order to enrich their lives and teach them to appreciate the beauty of great music." Unquote. Now this, we are, as readers, meant to scorn. Dagny, we don't have Dagny saying, "Ah, that was a load of crap." We don't have Ayn Rand coming out and saying, "Ah, that was a load of crap." What we have, though, is the next line, "Richard Halley retired." It's like, I'm done with this. And we, as readers, are meant to conclude that something is very wrong with the way that people are talking about art. And Ayn Rand now reveals that she hates that tortured artist trope. She hates that trope. And the reason she hates it is because it disdains the achievement of the individual and would rather have somebody suffer than have a true evaluation of the quality of what they are doing. So what we have here implied is that just like Hank Reardon in this book, and just like Howard Roark in The Fountainhead, if you've read that, there is a way to achieve, whether it's in the arts or whether it's in technology. And that achievement is something that should not be evaluated according to the whims of fashion, that there is a way to recognize that achievement and its greatness, that is not up to tastes that shift with fashion. But instead, there is something you can point to as greatness. What is that thing? The vision of the individual, the celebration of accomplishment and ambition. That there, if you can create something based on that ethos, then you deserve to be called great. And if it's art, you should have been celebrated. You shouldn't have had to be starving ever. So that's the argument here. And because society has failed to produce that kind of evaluation for Richard Halley, he's pissed off and he retires. And then he leaves. Just disappears. Another missing person who walked away. If you've read the book, you know what I'm alluding to. There will be no spoiler alert for that one. Nope. So then what happens? Dagny accidentally glimpses a newspaper headline about Francisco D'Anconia, and it's a violation. It's awful. Look at this. Look at what Dagny thinks to herself. Quote, "Don't read it," she thought. "Not now. Not to that music. Oh, not to that music." Unquote. So she can't help herself. She's reminded of Francisco D'Anconia, who is catering to fashion all the time and basically has made himself into a spectacularly worthless celebrity, which is like the definition of catering towards fashion. Like the opposite of being great is to be a spectacularly worthless celebrity. And then he says this absurd stuff about the gossip, right? And he's not going to deny anything because he never does. And that's like the opposite of what you should do. So it just goes to show how worthless he is. And he has no integrity because he's not even going to deny anything. And the contrast between Halley and D'Anconia is one of opposite. That if you're looking for someone who is a cheap suit, basically, it's Francisco D'Anconia. And this scene comes to an end with Dagny getting her attention back to Halley's music. And then we have the last line of the scene, quote, "It was her quest, her cry." And stylistically, this is nice because there's a double meaning to the word cry, because we can think battle cry, like, you know, matching a quest. But we can also think of tears, that what she's going through here is painful. And the pain is sort of like what Richard Halley went through, but instead of it being the art world that ignores Halley, we have kind of the decay of all of society that is taking Dagny down. So it's almost like a cry if you're being tortured in a way. You know, you're crying out in pain, right? And then also kind of a sorrow over Francisco D'Anconia, which we don't quite understand at this point in the book, but later on it'll be revealed just how close they were and how much of a betrayal and loss it is that Francisco D'Anconia has become this creature of basically worthlessness, is the word. So that is the end of the first chunk of chapter 4. And we've got two asterisks there to separate out what comes next. in the scene with Jim Taggart. And we're going to pause now. Next episode, we are going to finish up. Speaking of Francisco D'Anconia, we're going to finish up the money speech in episode 30, which is going to be a fast forward episode. So we're going to reach the conclusion of that money speech. And then in episode 31, we're going to come back to what we have just left off with, and we'll see what Jim Taggart is up to. Jim Taggart has fabulously amusing reaction to the nationalization of the San Sebastian line, so there's a lot to enjoy there if you enjoy watching Jim Taggart suffer, which, come on. I think maybe in all of literature, Jim Taggart is the character who is just like the most enjoyable to watch suffer. I'm interested to hear if any of you have a contender for that position in all of literature. So think about that and send me an email if anything comes to mind about who else in literature one enjoys watching suffer. And the email address for the show is socialistreads@gmail.com. Hey, if you have been enjoying this and would like to help me cover the costs of podcasting, visit my Patreon page. And those of you who have already been there and are contributing just a couple of bucks each month to help me out with the costs of this operation here, thank you. Thank you so much to those of you who are doing that. And if you're not able to at this time, do not worry. This podcast is here to be available for everybody who's interested in this book and the questions it raises. Okay, next episode, we go back to the money speech. I will talk to you then. Take care.